Veeam is eyeing Proxmox. Sync grabs Helios. TSMC's taking a little more time. CVE exploiting done the wrong way. AirDrop is a mess. A blizzard of Microsoft's own making. And a closer look at some growing IT power requirements in this episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Gestalt IT Rundown for Wednesday, January the 24th, 2024. And a very happy birthday, 40 years old today, the Apple Macintosh. So everyone out there should go run out and throw a sledgehammer into a giant TV screen, recreate that Super Bowl ad, because happy birthday to the computer that changed a lot of people's lives, including mine. My name is Tom Hollingsworth. I'm happy to be your host this week. And joining me, of course, is public enemy number one, Stephen Foskett. Stephen, welcome to the show.
It is great to be here. And man, was I on the wrong side of that thing. I was an Atari ST fan at the time. So I was all Macintosh. Well, now look at me.
Well, you know what? It's okay. I mean, technology changes so fast. We're never sure what's going on in the world, but thankfully you have us to at least give you a few highlights over the course of the week of all the great news stories that have come out. And we're going to go ahead and kick one of them off because you probably heard some of the brouhaha going on about the whole Broadcom and VMware acquisition. We've talked about it a little bit, but it's now leading to some very interesting explorations with other companies. News came out this week that backup giant and friend of the show, Veeam, is exploring support for Proxmox. This report highlights some growing concerns with the direction that Broadcom is taking, and it also reflects community interest in an open source alternative to commercial virtualization software. The conversation so far seems to be mostly Veeam employees replying to discussion threads on Veeam's discussion forums. So that indicates that Veeam is not only interested in what the community is seeing, but they're also trying to get the temperature of how people feel about the future of virtualization. Stephen, would Veeam support help with Proxmox's visibility?
Well, certainly it would. But to me, this story really isn't as much about Veeam as it is around Broadcom VMware. So think about it this way. Essentially, people were asking on forums, as people do, what's going to happen now that Broadcom has taken over VMware and changed licensing and canceled the availability of products and so on. People have a lot of FUD, a lot of worry, a lot of concern about what happens with their VMware investment and where they want to go next. That's pretty natural, and that's pretty widespread. Of course, people are looking at some alternatives. And I think that one of the alternatives that they're looking at is Proxmox, which, by the way, is very excellent. I sat for some time, I talked to the Proxmox folks, just a great team over there. They're doing some cool stuff. It's a good alternative. Is it the best alternative? Well, there's a lot of alternatives out there. Proxmox is certainly one of them. I mean, other people are thinking about KVM and, you know, well, maybe about what about Oracle Linux? What about Red Hat virtualization? What about some of the Kubernetes integrated alternatives? I've seen a lot of people talking about Harvester and things like that. So essentially, there are a lot of alternatives out there if people wanted to get off of VMware. And, you know, the Veeam folks are really sharp. I know a lot of them. They really know this space. They know the industry. They're not just focused on their product. And so, of course, they're looking at all of these alternatives. And if you are Veeam or if you're any of the companies in the VMware ecosystem, now's the time to carefully consider where the market may head. So, of course, that's what they're looking at. But that being said, they would also be sharp not to put too much resources into these alternatives, because it's not like Veeam is somehow going to dethrone VMware. That's not what they're talking about here at all. I think what they're talking about here is making sure that Veeam is able to support the needs of their customers, and, you know, regardless of the direction those customers want to head. And yes, if those customers want to head to Proxmox, and if that becomes a trend in 2024 or 2025, well, I think that would be really interesting for us in the tech community, and I think it would be really interesting for Veeam, and I think we can all rest assured that Veeam knows that that's a possibility, and they're taking a good look at it. Application security company Sneak is acquiring Helios to bolster their visibility into how data drives software security needs. The move is aimed to help close the gap between developers and SecOps teams that are trying to deliver user security after the program has been written. By aligning the build time and runtime aspects of application security, Sneak and Helios are hoping to help more teams shift left on DevSecOps. Tom, what's a key takeaway from this announcement?
So I think it's important for people to realize that just because a program is secure when it's built doesn't mean that it stays that way. I'm going to reference something that our good friend Corey, the editor of this show, likes to talk about all the time, video games. Remember when we were kids, or at least when Steven and I were kids, and everything was on a Nintendo cartridge? And once you bought it, that was that. Any bugs that were in that game stayed forever because you couldn't patch a cartridge. Well, a lot of software developers kind of look at their code inside of an application like that. Now, thankfully today, we have the ability to install updates and fix security holes and patch exploits. But the problem is you have to know that those things are going on. And that there's a little bit of a gap there, because if someone finds an exploit in your code, unless they're actively using it to break things, you may never know. That's actually one of the reasons why massive scale nation state hacking is such a huge problem. It's because those people really don't want you to know that there's a hole in the code that they can take over. So what Sneak did when they acquired Helios was they picked up a company that is absolutely focused on runtime security. They're doing data collection. They're seeing how the applications are being used. And more importantly, they're looking for ways that those applications can be misused. And by taking that information and feeding it back to Sneak, what they're effectively saying is, we can find the bad actors as they're actively exploiting this. Think about all of the times that you've heard over the last several years of rundown stories about how there was a gap between when the exploit was discovered and exploited, and then when the company found out that it was being misused. Usually there's weeks or possibly even months. And what's happening now is that with Helios, you can find out about that in, well, hours optimistically, but realistically more like days. So you can rush a patch out. And because it's really focused on things like cloud applications, you can rev those really fast to start closing some of those holes. And as we'll find out later, I think, you know, there are some companies that really wish they could patch these holes a little bit faster. So I think that this is overall a great pickup. It may not have all the flash of buying like a huge product line or a switch or putting a different label on something, but you'll see that as applications become more secure, it will be better overall for people because they will have to think about security a little bit less. Steven, here on the rundown, we love to talk about chips and fabrication facilities. And we had some news that came out about one of the highlights of the US's CHIPS Act. It was that TSMC was going to be building a fabrication facility in the state of Arizona. In fact, they were going to be building two of them. Well, the first one has faced some delays in construction due to reports from TSMC that they can't find enough skilled workers in Arizona. Now there are reports that the second fab facility could be delayed to 2027 or even 2028. In addition, that second plant may not start producing advanced 3-nanometer process chips, even with that construction delay. Now, there's a Bloomberg story that's reporting that some of that delay could be because of lack of funding from the CHIPS Act, because a lot of the companies that are seeking money from the U.S. federal government haven't gotten it yet. Steven, is the delay on this high-tech facility going to cause more issues for U.S.'s desires for domestic chip production?
Well, I think that the U.S.'s desires for domestic chip production were, well, let's say more politically than technologically or business related. Essentially, the U.S. really wants there to be a domestic chip industry and is really worried that a chip crunch that happened a couple of years ago could really face problems for U.S. companies and, importantly, for the Department of Defense going forward. Well, that's all true. The problem is that the way that they're trying to address this is basically to entice companies to build fabs in the U.S. when there really isn't sufficient, I don't want to say business demand, but there isn't sufficient business case for doing that. Companies are willing to do it if the U.S. is going to fund it. I mean, that kind of creates its own business case. But these companies are not stupid, whether it's Intel or TSMC or Samsung or any of the others that are talked about building fabs in the U.S. They would love to do it if it makes business sense, and the CHIPS Act kind of made that happen. But that being said, there's no need to rush headfirst into building a massive fab that's not only going to cost a lot to build, it's going to cost a lot to kit out, it's going to cost a lot to operate over time, and frankly, it has to make that money back. So what I see here is TSMC being predictably pretty cautious about where they're investing their time and money and resources, and trying to align the commitments that they've made with the reality of the market. And the reality of the market is that there really isn't a chip shortage right now. In fact, with the economic problems that have been facing the tech industry, there's not really a chip glut, but there's, you know, not really a problem to be solved here. That being said, a few years from now, when we have new process nodes, I mean, TSMC is already talking about 1 nanometer, they will need additional production space, and maybe they'll need production space for, you know, older process nodes. You know, by that point, 3 or 4, maybe an older process node, and they may want to produce those things in the U.S. at this Arizona fab. So, you know, that's what I see is going on. There is another aspect to this, though, that I think is really important. Here in Ohio, Intel is building a massive fab, and those of us who live here have heard quite a lot of excitement, but also a little nervousness around what that fab is doing to the Ohio economy. Essentially, these factories are incredible drivers of economic activity, but they also require a heck of a lot of skilled workers, basically construction workers to build the thing, advanced industrial workers to get the thing up and running and keep it running, and of course, highly skilled labor to operate the factory on a daily basis. Even in Ohio, where we don't have much conflict and we've got a great, great workforce, Intel is basically sucking all that up into their Ohio operations. The same thing is happening in places like Arizona and Austin, where these fabs are being built right now. And I am not at all surprised that labor is a challenge that TSMC is facing. Frankly, there's a lot of construction going on across the United States. The economy is pretty good, and there's a lot of competition for this labor. And not only that, but a lot of the labor that's happening here is union labor. And of course, union labor tends to be higher skilled, higher paid, and more scarce. So what's happening is companies like TSMC and Intel are looking around. They're trying to build these things. They're having trouble sourcing labor to get them done. And that is delaying things further. So in a way, this story about TSMC delaying the second fab, as you mentioned, this is the second fab, is more about them delaying the first fab because they couldn't get the labor and resources online to bring it up. And so to me, it is a more nuanced story than just TSMC isn't doing what they promised. That's not really what's going on here. TSMC is being smart, and they're reacting to what's going on in the overall market. Patching exploits is no small task. One way it gets easier is by tracking exploits, which is the purpose of Common Vulnerabilities and Exposure Programs, or CVEs. We talk a lot about CVEs on the rundown, but two companies are facing some flack for misusing the CVE process. The first is Juniper Networks, which has been accused of not filing some of their vulnerabilities with the CVE program. This means that tracking those potential exploits are very difficult, if not impossible. At the other end of the spectrum, we have a report that Ivanti has lumped several remote code execution vulnerabilities under a single CVE when they really should have each had their own number. Tom, what's going on here? Is the CVE process being misused, or is this something more nefarious?
I really hope that it's not something more nefarious, but unfortunately, I think it's almost kind of a reaction to the way that security vulnerabilities tend to get blown out of proportion. Not saying that vulnerabilities are not important. We absolutely need to track them. We need to patch them. We need to make sure that there are no issues with them. And here's the reason why. Because we've seen a couple of vulnerabilities that were 3-4 years old recently that have been, you know, mysteriously unpatched that come back to haunt companies later. But here's the way that I look at this. I was telling Corey before we started, it's like when your kids both figure out how to break a rule, but they both do it in completely different ways. And you're like, how did you manage to do that? So on the one hand, we got Juniper, who's like, they're saying, oh, well, we'll tell you what the CVE is when we release the patch for it. And one other thing to note, Juniper releases all of their patches, was it the second Wednesday of the first month of every quarter, which is really weird. Like, I know that everybody kind of jokes about Microsoft Patch Tuesday, but I figured they would release patches more recently than that. Here's an example of why the CVE program exists, because if there's a bug or an exploit in a software program, you really want to know about it so that you know that you've patched it. So you know that this patch addresses these issues. If it's release notes like we see from the Apple App Store sometimes, like, you know, fixed various bugs and improved performance. That doesn't help me as someone who has to secure this for 10,000 nodes. So there, I think they're just trying to maybe shine things up a little bit so that it doesn't look like they have nearly as many vulnerabilities as they really do. The Avanti thing almost to me feels kind of like someone was like, well, these all look the same. We should just file them together. Not realizing that every individual remote code exploit probably should have its own CVE. That way you know that there's multiple different ways to do that, even if it's from the same command shell injection. I honestly don't think that this was bad. Maybe they were trying to save face a little. Do better next time, both of you, please, because the only reason that this system works is because we all kind of agree to follow the same rules. As soon as somebody starts breaking the rules, then we have a massive issue. And if you think that it's not bad when you do it, just ask yourself this question. If your competitors did the same thing, would your marketing department tear them apart for it? A little food for thought. Speaking of exploits and vulnerabilities, Stephen, the Chinese authorities are leveraging a vulnerability in Apple's AirDrop hashing mechanism. They're breaking out the rainbow tables to de-anonymize users and identify those that have been involved in the mass distribution of prohibited content. And remember what's prohibited over there. Apple has been aware of this weakness for a few years, but so far they haven't fixed it. Now, Stephen, I know that we're kind of Apple fans around here, but is this an example of Apple kowtowing to a foreign government pressure? Or are we making something out of this that it really isn't?
Well, I think it's pretty safe to say that Apple is, well, hesitant to displease the Chinese government. After all, that's one of the biggest markets for their products and also the source of most of their products. But that being said, let's take a look at this AirDrop vulnerability and think about what it really means. So first off, this thing is pretty clever. If you're not familiar with AirDrop, well, there's been a lot of FUD about it, but the way AirDrop actually works is seemingly pretty sensible. I don't want to say pretty secure because we'll talk about that in a second. Essentially, it is a feature that lets users of Apple devices, typically iPhones, but it also works with Macs, share files with other Apple devices nearby. When you're configured to share files and accept shares and so on, you just magically show up in the AirDrop list and I can zoop a file over to you wirelessly, and that's that. Now, again, there's been some wild news stories about people airdropping, well, let's say less than welcome content to random people around them. And of course, as relating to this story, activists in China have really seized on AirDrop as a great way to distribute critical messages, leaflets, pamphlets, and so on, and to plan joint actions like strikes and so on with others nearby. That's pretty wild and certainly not something that the Chinese government appreciates. So the way that AirDrop works is kind of interesting. Essentially, if you think about it, what you can't do is you can't have every iPhone always asking wirelessly what every other iPhone is and building lists of every iPhone around you all the time. Because, you know, that sounds maybe a little fraught security-wise. So instead, what it does is a pretty interesting way of broadcasting anonymized hashes of your contacts and asking other phones for their anonymized hashes and comparing those lists to see if we have hashes in common. And if we do, and again, this is if you set AirDrop to only accept from people you know, which you should, and is the default, I think. Anyway, if you do have common contacts, then it allows those to be seen in AirDrop. So it's kind of a cool way to do it using hashing. Theoretically, this couldn't be reversed, but the way that Apple did it was the less secure way that kind of can be reversed. And essentially what the Chinese government did here, it looks like, is they built what's called a rainbow table. Rainbow table is basically you use a lot of computing resources to compute the hashes of everything. And then you can compare the hashes that are coming in and you'll know what they match because everything. And essentially what they did, it looks like, is they took every email address and phone number in China and maybe in the world, and hashed all of those. And so then they created basically an evil airdrop device that sits there waiting for people to make these airdrop requests. And it grabs and matches the hashes of everything those people are sending out. Pretty cool, pretty clever, pretty scary. So essentially what they're going to do is they're going to be not only able to snoop on airdrops, but they're basically going to be able to see, contacts that are in your phone, et cetera. They'll be able to know pretty much who it is. And that's all pretty bad. Apple has known about this vulnerability for a long time, years, at least since 2019, but they really haven't talked about it, and they certainly haven't fixed it. And Apple got a lot of criticism because previously what they did when the Chinese government complained about these, what Apple did was they reset the airdrop settings for everyone in China to limit sharing to contacts only. After they got some criticism for that, they rolled that out globally, which honestly kind of is how airdrops should be anyway. So I don't really fault them for that. I think they were too open at the beginning. But basically, they haven't responded to this at all. People are concerned now because essentially what it means is if you have airdrop turned on at all, then somebody using this rainbow table attack could know more about you than you want them to know. But I think a lot of people, including myself, don't really expect Apple to respond to this much at all. I suspect that if AirDrop is ever replaced, it'll probably be replaced with something a little more secure. But I don't think Apple's going to really change how it works anytime soon. And I think that this exploit is going to continue to work. Another week, Microsoft password. This time, a Russian-sponsored group known as Midnight Blizzard, ooh, sounds like a villain in a new Marvel movie, was able to break into Microsoft through a password spray attack and compromise a test tenant account with a bad password. From there, they did what they usually do. They moved laterally into some juicy executive accounts and made off with emails and some other fun stuff. Microsoft said the attack has been ongoing since November of 2023, which, come to think of it, isn't all that long, but probably long enough to get some good data out of there. And they were only able to determine the full extent, though, this month. Tom, is this really bad for Microsoft?
Well, you see, Mr. Foskett, Russian bear now owns Microsoft.
Sorry for the terrible Bond villain impersonation. Here's what happened, and this is one of those things. So everyone's heard of a brute force attack. It's like, I want to get into Steven's email, so I'm going to try every password under the sun. I'm going to use rainbow tables. I'm going to crack everything. This is the literal opposite of that. I have a list of like the top 100 passwords from like, have I been pwned? I'm just going to blast them in every possible permutation of user account that I can find. And that's effectively what happened, is they're just blasting this thing. I'm hoping that the reason why it took so long is because Microsoft has their AD accounts configured that after like so many failed retries, you have to back off and wait. One can hope. But what happened is that they were able to get into an account that someone had configured with a weak password. So every time that you think to yourself, oh, I saw that on the news, there's no way that I'd create an account with the password being capital PASSW0RD exclamation point. Are you sure that no one in your organization would do that? Because as long as one person did, that's what happened here. So you figure Microsoft has tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of accounts. Somebody misconfigured one of them with a bad password. This spray attack hit it, exploited it, and then it was off to the races. So what they were able to do is they were able to use a combination of kits to backdoor to get what they really wanted, which was to steal a whole bunch of executive emails, make off of some data, some other incriminating things, compromat, if you will, because effectively what they're trying to do is they're either trying to auction that data off or they're going to use it to create more problems for Microsoft in the future. It's a sophisticated hack for what effectively boils down to a gang of thugs, because let's be fair, if this was a real nation state sponsored attack, like from some other group, we wouldn't have heard about it. Microsoft wouldn't have detected it. It would have gone completely under the radar. And we would have only known about it when Microsoft started losing deals to other companies that were sponsored by other states or whatever. But unfortunately, whereas the other nation states are the sneaky cat burglars that are prowling around in the middle of the night to steal a priceless jewel from the laser security thing, these guys are more like the ones who will just drive a bulldozer through the wall and make off with the goods. So I'm glad that Microsoft caught them. I wish it hadn't have taken a couple of months for them to catch them, but there's really not a lot we could do. I first found out about the story because a Microsoft employee sent it to me, and it was kind of like, oops, it happened again. If I were Microsoft right now, I would have a full top to bottom deck clearing security audit of everything. Tighten the screws on everyone. Password expirations, security, password complexity rules. Don't just audit the users, audit everything. Yes, it's going to cause some problems, but would you rather have those problems caused by your investigative teams? Or would you rather be answering the phone from people like Brian Krebs asking for a comment on what just happened? I know which one I'd rather have. Stephen, we had a little bit of a closer look story that we wanted to put in here, because one of the biggest movements that we've seen out of corporate America in the last few years is ESG, environmental, social, and corporate governance, which is effectively companies saying we're going to try to do better by our social policies, the way that we do our business, but most importantly for a lot of them, our impact on the environment. Well, according to a recent report from the IEA, data center electricity demands are set to rise over the next 3 years. This report discusses the fact that CO2 emissions are going to go up when electricity usage goes up, and it also discusses potential mitigations that companies have committed to doing to make themselves a little bit more carbon neutral. Also of note was the assertion that clean energy resources could meet this growing demand and help offset the need to rely on older power systems, which are a lot harder to optimize for efficiency. Stephen, when we look through this report, I mean, there's a lot to unpack here, and there's a lot of ways that it impacts IT in general. How is this going to affect IT spending over the next few years?
Yeah, let's start by just talking about the report. And then what I'd like to do is kind of wrap up by talking about how we solve this problem. So first, think about the report. What does the International Energy Agency say? Well, essentially that global electricity demand is growing rapidly. In fact, they're projecting an average increase of 3.4% annually from 2024 to 2026. That may not seem a lot, but remember, we use a lot of electricity globally. And that means that this is going to affect everything on the planet. Now, this is demand. This is growth in demand. It doesn't, that doesn't say we're outstripping supply, as we'll get to here in a minute. It also doesn't specifically criticize this. Remember, electricity demand is actually, in many cases, more green and more sustainable and offsetting carbon use, non-electricity energy demands. What I mean by that is think of, well, obviously electric cars instead of, petroleum powered cars. Think about the shift from using coal and coke to electricity to make steel, or the shift from, burning fossil fuels to using heat pumps to make heat or cooling. Essentially, you know, we want global demand for electricity to grow. In fact, we want it to grow rapidly, because that means that we are offsetting some of the more dangerous and dirty things that we really don't want as a society. So let's set that part aside. Yes, demand is growing. When it comes to where demand is growing, that's an interesting aspect too, because a lot of this increase is coming outside of the advanced economies and in what we would consider to be sort of the rest of the world. So companies like China, which frankly is getting to be pretty advanced economy, India, same thing, Southeast Asia, but also places like Africa and South America, where, you know, the use of energy is growing as the economies overall are improving. And that's, again, probably a good thing on the whole for humanity. Another thing, of course, they do point out is, to my point about offsetting polluting sources, they're projecting that emissions are going to be reduced thanks to this, and that electricity prices probably won't rise because of other sources. So what this means overall for the world is actually not a bad thing. But Tom, let's zoom in a little bit and talk about what this means for data centers.
Yeah, I mean, according to some analysts, data center power requirements are going to grow, like they're going to double over the next 3 years. And one of the things that I think about is what's being run in those data centers that's causing that to happen. Because we've seen this massive shift to the cloud, right? Everybody wants to move their stuff out of their local data center or their local colo and put it into the cloud. So that means that maybe we're reducing the power consumption of that local colo, but we're also making what's going on in the cloud a little bit more power intensive. All you've got to do is look at the explosion of AI over the last year. Think about it like this. Google runs these massive data centers with all of these rack scale things, and Facebook has all of this stuff, right? Well, how does a program like ChatGPT affect power output? Because you're probably thinking to yourself, oh, well, you know, AI really doesn't use that much more power. Well, it depends on which phase you're talking about, because when they're actually running that algorithm, they're doing a lot of processing. They are burning a lot of CPU cycles. Maybe once that pass is made, it's a little bit easier to query the database or the model or whatever, but you've got to take the impact of the whole thing. It's like people who say that, you know, maybe this particular energy saving method is on the surface a lot more, environmentally friendly. But when you look at the way that it's processed before it actually is delivered, it has a lot bigger impact. Those are the things that we really have to think about. And I think that as cloud data centers become more capable, and we're able to more fully utilize them, I think overall, the power consumption for data centers is going to go up. Because now it's like, think about any car that you've ever owned. It's like, if the speedometer goes to 110, I'm going to drive it 110 at least one or two times, right? Just to prove that I can do it. Doesn't mean that I'm always going to do it that way. So when we look at a lot of companies that you and I have talked to over the last, you know, several years, when they're talking about, you know, reducing the per drive power consumption, or talking about things like a deeper sleep mode for devices so that they can really power them down so that when they're being used, obviously they're drawing power, but when they're not being used, they are effectively kind of silent. Because anyone who's ever built a computer knows that like GPUs are power hungry. Like even in my little computer here with a GPU that's a few years old, I'm still pulling 600 or 700 watts. Think about something like, I don't know, like a B100 card. That thing's probably pulling 1,000 watts, if not more, times how many cards are in that rack, times how many racks are in that data center. And of course, you know, analyst reports are going to look at the sum total of that power. But you and I would look at it and say, well, when it's running like 1,000 watts. But when it's not running, it's at 0 watts or like 1 watt. So the average is a little bit better, which helps that ESG report that the company is going to be putting out. I mean, Stephen, do you see it that way? Do you think that data centers need to get better about, you know, being efficient in their utilization, but also finding ways to drastically reduce the power costs when they're not being used?
Well, certainly one of the nicest things about cloud computing is that it can optimize the usage of assets that we have. And that is inherently green. In other words, if instead of having a bunch of servers sitting idle, we can have a different tenant, a different customer using those servers, then that's better than just manufacturing more servers that are going to sit idle. So I think inherently cloud computing is more efficient in terms of utilization of resources. But we have to get back to what economists call Jevons paradox. So English economist William Stanley Jevons observed that as you improve the efficiency of energy production and thus drive down the cost of energy production, it paradoxically increases usage. In other words, you can't win. what we've seen again and again and again and again, I studied sociology, that's my background. When you improve things, it automatically drives more demand. So to your point, if cars are capable of driving faster, people will tend to drive faster as long as it's not, you know, challenging to them. In storage, I have a laughingly called Foskett's Law, which is that, you know, your use of storage increases to take up all available capacity. Essentially, if you have a resource, you're going to use it. And that has some pretty ominous overtones when we think about things like cloud computing and artificial intelligence. In other words, having this capability means that we're going to figure out how to use it. We saw it in crypto. We're certainly seeing it in AI. Everything's getting AI, whether it needs it or not, you know, because it's there. It's available. We can use it. And we've seen this in software, too, as software programming models have gone higher and higher level and software programming has become easier and easier. It's become less efficient, but the hardware has become more plentiful and effectively we've wiped out all the gains in hardware advancements that we've made because we're just soaking it up with software. I think it's pretty clear that we're going to soak all this stuff up. So let's get back to this. So as Jivan's noted back in the 19th century, no kidding, in the 1865, we're seeing the same thing with electricity demand. Electricity demand is just going through the roof. More and more things are using more and more electricity, especially in the data center. I mean, we've got kilowatt parts now being installed in servers. We're getting back to the point where we're going to have power and cooling demands that are just going to be unheard of previously because we can. And you know what? We're not going to probably stuff that genie back in the bottle. The question that we have to ask is, how do we make better use of that stuff? And Tom, maybe, you know, do you want to talk a little bit about how we can maybe improve this situation before I talk about basically a slam dunk that makes this not as much of a problem?
Well, I mean, there's always ways to do it. And we're trying to do as best we can, you know, things like reducing older fossil fuel plants, like we're retiring coal. A lot of companies are starting to look at, you know, should we lobby to have nuclear power brought back online? Because, I mean, that's something that we really need to consider. But also, you know, things like electricity prices. Like, are you buying at the spot price, which we know can fluctuate? Are you negotiating with your power providers? Are you offsetting the ways that you're doing that? I remember growing up, there was this crazy guy on the hill in a small town who had one of those big wind generators by his house. Well, it wasn't as big as the ones we have now. And I thought that was the craziest idea until I realized, yeah, he doesn't need to pay nearly as much for electricity. Now imagine that at a scale. Maybe you're not going to get megawatts of power out of one of those things to power like something the size of SuperNap in Vegas. But, you know, I think that that's something that you need to consider. I mean, there's a lot of ways that you can look outside of the data center to do this. A lot of things in general, because let's be fair. Fusion power is not coming along anytime soon. I wish it was, because then that would solve all of the energy problems that we have, except for that pesky law. You know, now that we have more energy, we're going to keep using more energy. You know, we need to look at, you know, prioritizing clean energy. We need to make that worth the while of the people who are investing in it, whether it's solar or wind or all these other stuff. And quite honestly, we need to be realistic about our usage of those devices, because if we just have them sitting there powered on, we're drawing power that we don't need to use. But Stephen, what's the slam dunk that would really fix all of these problems?
The slam dunk that fixes all these problems is something called solar. Now, those of you who are listening, I imagine some of you probably just groaned, but bear with me. So as you know, solar panels have been improving radically over the year, and to the point that photovoltaic solar panels today are so cheap that it is cheaper to buy, provision, permit, and install a field full of solar panels to generate the same amount of electricity than it is to literally just pump natural gas into an existing natural gas-fired plant to generate that same amount of electricity. It is that cheap already. And what's happening is that the efficiencies of solar panels are projected to increase at a 20, 30, 40% rate over the next 10 years, which means that we're going to have even cheaper solar power. What this means is, paradoxically, that solar is now so compelling that it's being adopted by people you would not expect would adopt it. Here in the United States, there is more solar being deployed in so-called red states than there is in so-called blue states. Those of you who aren't Americans, that means that the sort of people who you might suspect would be all, you know, fossil fuels and gasoline and coal and all that kind of stuff, well, they're deploying solar at a more rapid rate than those tree-hugging environmentalists that you would think, you know, the liberals that are driving their electric cars and stuff. Why are they doing this? They're doing it because it makes financial sense. They're doing it because solar is cheaper. There's plenty of space to put it. It's cheap and easy to deploy. And frankly, that fixes this problem. And it fixes it in a way that helps us all and allows us to move forward. I hear a lot of garment rending over how much power AI uses. You're right. AI uses a ton of power. I hear a lot of people griping and moaning about all these powerful new GPUs and CPUs and kilowatt this and cooling that. Well, guess what? The coolest thing is that the solution is here in the form of solar. Now, obviously, solar only works about a third of the day because, you know, it gets dark here about half the day and, you know, there's clouds and storms and so on. But even at that, we've got really good battery capacity. Batteries are being deployed at massive scale. Battery technology is improving. People may gripe that it's not, but it so is if you do the research. What you'll find is that battery power has improved to such an extent that it is now affordable to deploy enough battery capacity to collect that third of a day of sunlight and power something all day long, all night long, with renewable energy. And guess what? It's here, it works, and it's already cost competitive, and it will become much, much more than cost competitive in the future. So I agree with this report. I agree with those of you who say that this stuff uses a lot of power, but I want to posit that maybe that's not the problem you think it is.
Yeah, and overall, I mean, we're aware of it. This isn't a situation that's going to grow out of control. We know that we need to be better, and so we're going to constantly be looking for ways to be better, whether it's charging an electric car or running an AI algorithm or being able to order a peanut butter and jelly sandwich from a delivery system, which, by the way, you should because it's National Peanut Butter Day. Well, I think that's just going to about do it for this episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown. Now, as you know, we have a lot of things that are going on over the next couple of weeks that we want to make you aware of because we don't just report on the news. Sometimes we help other people make it. Stephen, what are you going to be doing next week?
Well, next week is Cloud Field Day. So please tune in Wednesday and Thursday, January 31st and February 1st for Cloud Field Day. We start at 8 a.m. with a company called Neuroblade that's doing a data accelerator card. It is very cool stuff. At 10:30 Pacific, we've got Soft Iron presenting, and it's going to be an announcement. You watch. At 1 o'clock, we've got Platform 9 talking about how they're optimizing financials in the cloud. And then Thursday, we've got the morning with Dell Technologies talking about how Dell is enabling multi-cloud use. Then at 1 o'clock, we've got Broadcom coming in and wrapping up talking about networking in the cloud. So you don't want to miss it. Go to techfieldday.com or follow TechFieldDay on LinkedIn for more.
And then right after that, like the next week, I'm going to be in Amsterdam for Cisco Live EMEA. We're going to have Cisco presentations. We've already mentioned that. But I'm happy to announce we're also going to be having presentations from our friends at IP Fabric and Netbox Labs. You're going to want to tune in for that. The schedule is posted on the website at techfieldday.com. Please note that the times that are listed on that schedule are in Amsterdam time, which is GMT plus one. Also that week, I'll be bringing you the rundown from Amsterdam with a special guest co-host. So you're going to want to tune in for that. And then I'm going to take a week off to catch up on sleep and jet lag while Stephen, you do something really brainy.
Well, we've got AI Field Day coming up February 21st and 23rd. So that's Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. AI Field Day is our first three-day field day event of the year. We're extremely excited with an incredible, incredible list of companies. So Intel is our signature sponsor there. They're sponsoring an entire day. But Intel is bringing in partners, and I cannot wait to tell you who those partners are because it's some cool, cool AI-related companies. We've also got companies like Solidigm, VMware, Hammerspace, talking about other parts of the AI infrastructure, AI platform world. So excited to have AI Field Day coming up. It's going to be huge.
And I'm very excited to announce that the very next week is our first networking-focused event of 2024, and we have a brand new presenter that we want to tell you about, Viz Networks. if you are at all interested in Sonic, and I'm not talking about the Cherry Limeade restaurant, I'm talking about the Enterprise Network OS architecture, you're going to want to tune in for their special introductory session, because they've got a lot to say about it. This is an area that's growing in the space. We did a roundtable about it last year at Tech Field Day, and that thing has gotten thousands of views so far. So make sure you're ready for that. That's the 28th and 29th. We are taking full advantage of that leap day this year. Just like we take full advantage of every Wednesday at around 12:30 Eastern time with all of our friends out there in the community. We look for all the great news stories that are important to you, the ones that have an impact on IT and technology. Yeah, we cover acquisitions and we cover exploits and things like that. Yeah, maybe not so much about the new series funding round or somebody is now the chief revenue officer, because we want to do the stuff that matters to you. We want to keep it techie around here because Steven and I are nerds, let's be fair. And if you're a nerd that wants to follow us on all of our things, make sure you're subscribed to the YouTube channel so you know when the videos get posted. That's Gestalt IT Video. Read the show notes on gestaltit.com. See if you can work out all the little snarky things that we put in there. And then if you want to listen to us on your run or your walk or when you're mowing your yard, when you have a yard again, or snow blowing your driveway, just look for the Gestalt IT Rundown in your favorite podcast application of choice. And do remember that we love to hear your feedback. We love to see your comments. They really keep us going, you know, as we go through our day. So make sure you leave a comment. Make sure you share this episode with a friend if you found something interesting or useful with it, because we want to grow our listenership as much as possible. We'll be back next Wednesday with more great content. Until then, enjoy a peanut butter sandwich next to your Macintosh. Just do it, because it's National Just Do It Day as well. And we will see you in a week. We'll be right back.